Hello and welcome to the Pediatric Critical Care Medicine Audio Abstracts. I'm Dr. Erin Bennett, and on behalf of PCCM, I'm happy to present this audio recording of the research abstracts that appear in this month's issue. Let's get started. Abstract 1 is a featured original research article by C. et al. Estimation of central venous pressure using cardiac ultrasound of inferior vena cava in ventilated children, a prospective multicenter observational study from 2021 to 2023. Objectives. Despite its numerous limitations, especially in predicting fluid responsiveness, trends in central venous pressure or CVP values may be useful for managing certain critically ill pediatric patients. Although ultrasound parameters of the inferior vena cava, or IVC, cannot be used to estimate CVP in adults under mechanical ventilation, the pediatric literature reports highly contradictory results. Design: prospective multicenter observational study. Setting: 6 PICUs in France. Patients: children 2 days to 12 years old undergoing mechanical ventilation and had a central venous catheter in the superior vena cava to monitor CVP from November 1, 2021 to June 30, 2023. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Ultrasound measurements, IDEST, IVC maximum diameter and IVC minimum diameter were performed by experienced intensivists in order to calculate the following parameters. 1. IVC collapsibility, which is equal to IVC maximum diameter minus IVC minimum diameter divided by IVC maximum diameter times 100. 2. IVC distensibility, which is equal to IVC maximum diameter minus IVC minimum diameter divided by IVC minimum diameter times 100. And 3. IVC divided by aortic, which was equal to IVC maximum diameter divided by aortic times 100. The search for correlation was studied using Spearman correlation tests because of monotonic relationships. We included 120 children with a median age of 11.5 months with an interquartile range of 2 to 46.3 months and a median weight of 9 kilograms with an interquartile range of 5 to 15 kilograms. A third of the patients were admitted for postoperative care, including cardiac surgery, and a quarter for respiratory failure, with a median CVP of 7.5 millimeters of mercury and an interquartile range of 5 to 10.3 millimeters of mercury. No significant relationship was found between CVP and IVC collapsibility, IVC to aortic, or IVC distensibility. IVC collapsibility Spearman coefficient was equal to negative 0.09 with a p-value equal to 0.32. IVC to aortic Spearman coefficient was equal to 0.17 with a p-value equal to 0.06. And IVC distensibility Spearman coefficient was equal to negative 0.09 with a p-value equal to 0.29. Conclusions. There is no correlation between CVP and IVC ultrasound parameters in children under mechanical ventilation. Abstract 2 is a featured original research article by Madden et al. Social Determinants of Health and Delirium in the PICU, Secondary Analysis of a 2014 to 2015 Observational Dataset. Objectives: to explore the association between geospatial determinants of health and prevalence of delirium in the PICU. Design: non-pre-specified secondary analysis of an observational study dataset. Setting: urban academic tertiary care PICU. Patients: all children admitted over a 12-month period in 2014 to 2015. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Of 1,547 admissions, there were 1,264 individual patients, with race and ethnicity subgroup recorded for 961, or 76%, insurance status for 1,240, or 98%, and language for 1,227, or 97%. Child Opportunity Index was determined by a patient's 2010 census tract and was available for 1,246, or 98%. Data were grouped from 1, very low, to 5, very high. PICU delirium was present in 193 patients during PICU admission, with PICU delirium rates highest in Asian or Pacific Islander in 26, Black, non-Hispanic, in 29, and Hispanic in 39, as compared with white, non-Hispanic children, with an N equal to 45, and a p-value less than 0.001. Picudalarium was higher for patients with public insurance in 113 of 573, or 20%, compared with those with private insurance, 67 of 583, or 12%, and those with other, 8 of 84, or 10%, forms of support. The p-value here was less than 0.001. We failed to identify a difference in delirium rates by language preference. A higher prevalence of delirium was present among patients in the lowest child opportunity index groups 1 to 3 as compared with highest 4 to 5, 135 of 748 or 18% versus 55 of 494 or 11%, with a p-value equal to 0.003. In multivariable analysis, child opportunity index was associated with greater adjusted odds of delirium after adjusting for other demographic and clinical predictors of delirium, including age, developmental disability, severity of illness at admission, need for invasive mechanical ventilation, depth of sedation, and medication exposures. With adjusted odds ratio of 1.55, a 95% confidence interval of 1.05 to 2.3, and a p-value equal to 0.028. Conclusions. In a 2014 to 2015 PICU dataset, we have identified an association between lower child opportunity index and greater adjusted odds of delirium. This finding calls for further study to investigate potential mediators of this relationship. Abstract 3 is a featured original research article by Mehta et al., a novel MRI scoring system for brain injury after pediatric out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, a two-center retrospective cohort from 2016 to 2020. Objectives: to create a simple scoring system to evaluate the extent of brain injury on MRI after pediatric out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. Design: two-center retrospective cohort from 2016 to 2020. Setting: two tertiary care children's hospitals serving Northern California. Patients: children older than 48 hours and younger than 18 years old at admission who experienced out-of-hospital cardiac arrest within 24 hours before admission and underwent brain MRI within 8 days following arrest. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results: brain abnormalities on diffusion-weighted and T2 fluid attenuated inversion recovery MRI in 6 brain regions were summed to quantify severity of injury, with 1 point for each region in the following: deep structures, including basal ganglia, thalamus, and or posterior limb of the internal capsule, cortex, white matter, brainstem, hippocampus, and cerebellum. Unfavorable neurologic outcome was defined using pediatric cerebral performance category score greater than or equal to 1 point above baseline, resulting in a hospital discharge pediatric cerebral performance category score greater than or equal to 3. There were 58 children included, and 41, or 71%, had unfavorable outcome. In those with unfavorable outcome, 4 of 41 had no evidence of injury with an MRI score of 0, whereas 15 of 17 with favorable outcome had a MRI score of 0, with a p-value less than 0.001. No patient with favorable outcome had evidence of injury in deep structures with a p-value of less than 0.001, brainstem with a p-value equal to 0.003, cerebellum with a p-value equal to 0.024, or hippocampus with a p-value less than 0.001. There were 28 of 41 unfavorable outcome patients who had a MRI score greater than or equal to 3, whereas no children, 0 of 17, with favorable outcome had a MRI score greater than or equal to 3. After adjusting for presence of bystander cardiopulmonary resuscitation, witnessed arrest, and estimated time to return of spontaneous circulation, the pre to post test probability of unfavorable outcome with a MRI score greater than or equal to 3 went from 71% to greater than 99%, 0.996 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.8 to 1. Conclusions. Our simple 6-point MRI scoring system developed in a 2016 to 2020 cohort of pediatric out-of-hospital cardiac arrest cases managed in 2 centers shows an association with outcome, with a post-test probability of unfavorable outcome greater than 99% with an MRI score greater than or equal to 3. Abstract 4 is a featured original research article by Kwan et al. Arterial changes after vascular reconstruction following decannulation from extracorporeal life support, single center retrospective cohort from 2002 to 2022. Objectives: decannulation after pediatric extracorporeal life support, or ECLS, may be accompanied by arterial reconstruction. There is a paucity of data on arterial morphology following reconstruction. We sought to characterize morphology of reconstructed arteries to better understand long-term risk of arterial narrowing and blood flow alteration. Design. Retrospective single institution review from 2002 to 2022. Setting. Freestanding 420-bed quaternary care children's hospital in the U.S. Pacific Northwest. Patients. We identified children of any age who are decannulated from ECLS with arterial reconstruction using a 20-year registry. We excluded patients who did not survive. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. We collected patient demographics data, indications for ECLS, reconstruction strategies, surgeon specialty, and any available post-decannulation imaging results. Associations between variables and morphologic changes were assessed on univariate analysis and then combined into a forward stepwise multivariable regression model, using p equals 0.2 as a threshold. Among surviving patients, 144 underwent carotid artery reconstruction and 25 femoral, with 59 of 144, or 41%, and 23 of 25, respectively, undergoing post-reconstruction imaging. Follow-up imaging was performed at a median of 21 and 9 days, respectively. On follow-up, 25 of 59 patients, or 42%, undergoing carotid reconstruction, and 8 of 23 patients undergoing femoral reconstruction had occlusion or other morphologic changes on imaging. Neonatal age at reconstruction was a significant risk factor for these changes. Conclusions. A considerable proportion of patients undergoing arterial reconstruction after decannulation from ECLS develop vessel occlusion or other morphologic changes in short-term follow-up. Longer-term imaging is critical to aid risk stratification as ECLS survivors enter adulthood with attendant risks for atherosclerotic vascular disease. Abstract 5 is a clinical investigation article by Ochanya Alcabar et al. Impact of body size on stroke volume response to passive leg raising in spontaneously breathing children. Objectives: to test whether indexing stroke volume change to body size during the passive leg raising test in spontaneously breathing children improves accuracy to detect fluid responsiveness. Design: observational study. Setting: two pediatric hospitals. Patients: children 2 to 16 years old. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. In study phase 1, we measured stroke volume change by echocardiography during passive leg raising in healthy children. A positive passive leg raising test was defined as a mean stroke volume change greater than or equal to 10%. The correlation between stroke volume change with body size parameters was assessed, and optimal body size indexation was generated. In study phase 2, the passive leg raising was performed in acutely ill children before a fluid challenge of 20 milliliters per kilogram of normal saline. Stroke volume change was measured at 10 and 20 milliliters per kilogram, and fluid responsiveness was defined as stroke volume change greater than or equal to 10% or greater than or equal to 15%, four possible definitions of fluid responsiveness. The diagnostic performance of the passive leg raising using non-indexed and indexed stroke volume change to identify fluid responsiveness was assessed using the area under the receiver operating characteristic curve analyses. We recruited 133 and 87 children in phase 1 and 2, respectively. Mean stroke volume change and the proportion of positive passive leg raising test increased with age tertiles both in healthy children and children receiving a fluid challenge, with a p-value less than or equal to 0.01. Stroke volume change positively correlated with body size. Indexing by height removed the effect of body size. The area under the receiver operating characteristic curve of the passive leg raising test for fluid responsiveness ranged from 0.745 to 0.802, depending on the fluid responsiveness definition applied. The use of height-indexed stroke volume change improved diagnostic performance with an area under the receiver operating characteristic curve range of 0.852 to 0.894 compared to non-indexed stroke volume change, although the result was significant only when fluid responsiveness was defined as stroke volume change greater than 15% after 20 milliliters per kilogram, with a DeLong test result less than 0.05. Conclusions. The response in stroke volume change to a passive leg raising test is greatly influenced by body size. Indexing the value by height may improve the diagnostic performance of the passive leg raising test in children. Abstract 6 is a clinical investigation article by Durvin et al. Return to care after discharge directly home from the PICU, a propensity-matched cohort study. Objectives: to compare the proportion of PICU patients returning to the emergency department or readmitted within 14 days of hospital discharge between those discharged directly home from the PICU and those transferred to acute care before discharge home. We hypothesize that rates of return to care would be similar. Design: propensity-matched multicenter cohort study. Setting: 45 U.S. hospitals participating in pediatric health information systems. Patients: children admitted to a non-neonatal cardiac or PICU from 2016 to 2023. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Of 560,815 PICU discharges, 150,126, or 26.8%, were discharged directly home, although this proportion varied by center, 9.8% to 55.6%. We matched 94,048 children, or 62.6%, discharged directly home to 153,887 ward transfer children at admission year, admission type, principal diagnosis, and a propensity score estimating the likelihood of being discharged directly home. Compared with ward transferred peers, children discharged directly home had similar rates of return to emergency department care, 2.9% versus 3%, with an odds ratio of 0.94 and an interquartile range of 0.89 to 0.99, and hospital readmission, 4.8% versus 4.9%, with an odds ratio of 0.97 and an interquartile range of 0.94 to 1.01 within 14 days. Once readmitted, however, children discharged directly home were more likely to be readmitted to a PICU, 2.4% versus 1.6%, with an odds ratio of 1.58 and an interquartile range of 1.49 to 1.67. Costs for the index hospitalization were lower for children discharged directly home compared with ward transferred peers, leading to lower inpatient healthcare costs over 14 days, with a median of $15,023 and a range of $7,614.5 to $34,294.6 versus $30,750 with a range of $14,558.3 to $68,830.6 and a p-value less than or equal to 0.001. Conclusions. Discharge directly home from the PICU is common. Children discharged directly home have comparable likelihood of return to emergency department or inpatient care as matched ward discharged peers. Discharge directly home for appropriate patients may provide increased efficiency for healthcare systems. Abstract 7 is a clinical investigation article by Fan et al. The Phoenix Sepsis Score Criteria in Critically Ill Children. Evaluation using a retrospective single-center PICU cohort in China from 2019 to 2024. Objectives: to evaluate the Phoenix sepsis score and criteria in PICU children with suspected or confirmed infection. Additionally, to assess Phoenix sepsis score performance in relation to in-hospital mortality. Design: retrospective data from a 2019 to 2024 cohort. Setting: single-center, multidisciplinary, tertiary PICU in China. Patients: in 2,584 patient encounters, 0 to 18 years old, there were 2,396 separate encounters with suspected or confirmed infection. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. The Phoenix sepsis score was calculated as the sum of four organ subscores: respiratory, cardiovascular, neurologic, and coagulation, using the worst post-admission data from the first 24 hours. Sepsis was defined as a Phoenix sepsis score greater than or equal to 2 points and septic shock as sepsis with greater than or equal to 1 point in the cardiovascular subscore. In 2,396 patient encounters with suspected or confirmed infection, 1,261 or 52.6% with sepsis had a 19.9% mortality rate in 251 of 1,261. And 45.4% or 573 of 1,261 with septic shock had a 34.9% mortality rate in 200 of 573. Non-survival versus survival was associated with a higher median Phoenix sepsis score. 5 points with an interquartile range of 3 to 7 points versus 2 points with an interquartile range of 2 to 3 points and a p-value less than 0.001. Also, in-hospital mortality rate increased with progressively higher Phoenix sepsis score points. A Phoenix sepsis score greater than or equal to 2 points had an area under the receiver operating characteristic curve of 0.81 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.78 to 0.84 for in-hospital mortality. Comparison with the International Pediatric Sepsis Consensus Conference, or IPSCC, criteria, or the Pediatric Sequential Organ Failure Assessment, or PSOFA score, showed that the Phoenix sepsis score had better performance in identifying death rate for those patients with sepsis and for those with septic shock. Conclusions. In our single-center PICU cohort from 2019 to 2024 from China, among patient encounters with suspected or confirmed infection, the Phoenix sepsis score showed good discriminatory ability in identifying sepsis or septic shock. It also outperformed the IPSCC criteria and the PSOFA score in classifying in-hospital mortality. These analyses support the potential utility of the Phoenix sepsis score for risk stratification in our international PICU settings. Abstract 8 is a clinical investigation article by Mas et al., Reproducibility of Mechanical Power Equations in Ventilated Critically Ill Children. Objectives. We aim to assess the reproducibility of mechanical power equations in comparison with the geometric method in critically ill children during respiratory support with invasive pressure-controlled ventilation. Design. Prospective exploratory research study. Setting. Single-center PICU in the Netherlands. Patients included children less than 18 years old admitted to the PICU receiving pressure-controlled ventilation. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Mechanical power was calculated in a cohort of 37 children with a median age of 12 months and an interquartile range of 2 to 60 months. Three previously proposed mechanical power equations, including simplified, comprehensive, and linear mechanical power, were compared with the geometric mean, or gold standard, measuring the area under the pressure-volume loop, and assessed using agreement Bland-Altman analysis and reliability, intra-class correlation coefficient analysis of parameters. The mean difference was as follows. Simplified mechanical power, negative 0.02 joules per minute with a 95% confidence interval of negative 1.02 to 0.99 joules per minute. Comprehensive mechanical power, 0.03 joules per minute with a 95% confidence interval of negative 0.94 to 1 joule per minute. And linear mechanical power, 0.16 joules per minute with a 95% confidence interval of negative 0.76 to 1.08 joules per minute. The intraclass correlation coefficient for all comparisons were excellent. It est greater than 0.99 with a p-value less than 0.001. Conclusions. In critically ill children undergoing invasive pressure-controlled ventilation, all three mechanical power equations acceptably reproduce the geometric method for calculating mechanical power in joules per minute. Abstract 9 is a clinical investigation article by Connor et al. Turnover and Retention of Pediatric Cardiac Critical Care Nurses in the United States, a 2022 to 2023 Interprofessional Qualitative Analysis. Objectives. Nursing turnover is a significant vulnerability in healthcare systems. Although adult critical care nurses are among the highest group of nurses leaving the workforce, we do not have information about pediatric cardiac critical care nurse turnover. We have, therefore, explored pediatric cardiac critical care nurse turnover in focus groups recruited from interprofessional members of the Pediatric Cardiac Intensive Care Society, or PCICS. Design. Qualitative descriptive inquiry using focus groups and interviews. Setting. Interprofessional focus group discussions in 2022 to 2023. Subjects. 34 participants, representing less than 4% of the PCICS membership, were involved in focus groups and interviews. Interventions. The transcripts of focus groups and interviews were used to explore perspectives regarding pediatric cardiac critical care nurse turnover, its potential impact, and the potential solutions to enhance retention. Content analysis coding was used to identify themes and subcategories to support data interpretation. Measurements and main results. Data were organized into three main themes: nursing turnover, nursing retention, and solutions. For the themes of nursing turnover and nursing retention, there were two subcategories, meaning and impact. All participants reported that increased levels of nursing turnover impacted ICU morale. Higher turnover was also believed to increase patient vulnerability at the bedside, requiring higher levels of surveillance and support from the interprofessional team. Potential solutions to enhance retention included competitive salary and benefits packages, professional development for the multi-generational workforce, and a commitment to a healthy work environment. Conclusions. In 2022 to 2023, 34 PCICS members from the United States gave their perspectives and understanding of turnover in pediatric cardiac critical care nurses. Nursing turnover and its impact on the team highlights the urgent need to collaboratively identify and implement solutions to enhance nurse retention in this area of highly specialized practice. The PCICS and other such organizations may have a role in addressing nursing shortages and continued turnover. Abstract 10 is a clinical investigation article by Whitworth et al. Development, Implementation, and Evaluation of a Pediatric Pulmonary Embolism Clinical Pathway and Pulmonary Embolism Response Team. Objectives. U.S. multicenter pediatric data from 2001 to 2014 indicate that the prevalence of pediatric pulmonary embolism is rising, yet it remains rare at individual centers. Evaluation and management vary due to the low frequency of events, and therefore we aim to develop, implement, and evaluate a clinical management pathway and PE response team, or PERT, at our center. Design, single-center observational implementation study with pre- versus post-implementation comparisons. Setting, quaternary care pediatric hospital. Patients, pediatric patients younger than 21 years old with acute pulmonary embolism who presented for care between January 2005 and August 2022, pre-implementation, and between September 2022 and August 2024, post-implementation. Interventions, implementation of a pulmonary embolism clinical pathway and pulmonary embolism response team. Measurements and main results. A pulmonary embolism clinical pathway and pulmonary embolism response team were developed by a multidisciplinary team of pharmacists, quality improvement experts, and physicians from six clinical specialties. Electronic medical record tools were created to support the implementation of this pathway and pulmonary embolism response team, and research and quality databases were created for ongoing evaluation. Pulmonary embolism evaluation was standardized with the implementation of the pulmonary embolism clinical pathway. In the 23 months post-implementation, there have been 33 patients with acute pulmonary embolism, 24 low-risk, 7 intermediate-risk, and 2 high-risk pulmonary embolism, which we compared with our pre-pathway experience of 175 episodes. The proportion of patients who had laboratory testing with brain natriuretic peptide and troponin or underwent echocardiogram during their admission increased pre- versus post-implementation, respectively. For brain natriuretic peptide, it was 50 of 175 versus 30 of 33 with a p-value of less than 0.01. For troponin, it was 55 of 175 versus 30 of 33 with a p-value less than 0.01. And for echocardiogram, it was 142 of 175 versus 32 of 33 with a p-value of less than 0.02. The multidisciplinary pulmonary embolism response team was successfully activated for 7 patients with intermediate or high-risk pulmonary embolism. Conclusions. Implementation of a pediatric pulmonary embolism clinical pathway and pulmonary embolism response team improved standardization of pulmonary embolism evaluation and provided rapid multidisciplinary care for intermediate and high-risk pulmonary embolism. Future reports will evaluate both short- and long-term clinical outcomes in these patients. Abstract 11 is a clinical investigation article by Dillon et al. IV calcium use and outcomes after congenital heart surgery in infants under 6 months old, 3-center retrospective cohort from 2020 to 2022. Objectives. IV calcium is used frequently in the pediatric cardiovascular ICU or CVICU for neonates and infants undergoing congenital heart surgery. Since critical illness is associated with abnormal cellular calcium handling and adverse effects induced by hypercalcemia, we aimed to 1. Describe calcium use across 3 CVICUs, 2. Determine explanatory factors related to hypercalcemia and calcium administration, and 3. Evaluate associations with outcome. Design. Retrospective cohort analysis from January 2020 to December 2022. Setting. 3 university-affiliated CVICUs. Patients. Children younger than 6 months undergoing congenital heart surgery receiving postoperative monitoring of ionized calcium. there were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Average ionized calcium for every 24-hour period was calculated from tests drawn during the first 72 hours after congenital heart surgery. Of 276 infants evaluated, 119, or 43%, were neonates, 62, or 23%, underwent the Society of Thoracic Surgeons European Association for Cardiothoracic Surgery, or STAT, Category 4 and 5 surgery, and 44, or 16%, had single ventricle physiology. Median age was 50 days with an interquartile range of 8 to 113 days. IV calcium utilization differed between centers, with calcium administered in 21%, 62%, and 96% of cohorts with a p-value less than 0.001 at respective hospitals. Hypercalcemia was more prevalent in neonates with a p-value equal to 0.02, patients with longer cardiopulmonary bypass times with a p-value equal to 0.02, and patients with higher postoperative vasoactive inotrope scores with a p-value equal to 0.001. Children receiving top 10% of total calcium administration compared with those receiving some calcium and no calcium were younger, with a p-value less than 0.001, experienced higher rates of cardiac arrest, with a p-value equal to 0.02, longer CVICU length of stay, with a length of stay p-value less than 0.001, and lower survival rates, with a p-value less than 0.001. In multivariable analyses, we failed to identify associations between hypercalcemia and receiving top 10% calcium administration with length of stay or mechanical ventilation duration. Conclusions. In 2020 to 2022, post-congenital heart surgery calcium management in neonates and infants varied across our three CVICUs. Increased calcium administration and hypercalcemia occurred in high-risk populations, including neonates and STAT category greater than or equal to 4. Future experimental designs are needed to better understand these relationships and optimize CVICU postoperative calcium management. Abstract 12 is an original research article by Lasso Palomino et al., Fluid Overload and Outcomes in Pediatric Patients with Moderate or Severe Traumatic Brain Injury, Single Center Retrospective Cohort Study in Colombia. Objective: to identify factors associated with fluid overload and early outcomes in pediatric patients with moderate or severe traumatic brain injury, or TBI. Design: retrospective cohort study using patient electronic medical records. Setting: Hospital Universitario Fundación Valle de Lili, a tertiary care university hospital in Cali, Colombia. Patients: pediatric patients 1 to 16 years old treated in the PICU for moderate or severe TBI between 2011 and 2022. Measurements and main results. We identified 158 pediatric patients who met study inclusion criteria. We recorded baseline clinical characteristics and interventions administered in the PICU. Fluid overload was defined as a cumulative fluid balance greater than or equal to 10% of body weight on the third day after trauma. Outcomes included mechanical ventilation duration, acute kidney injury, functional status, and mortality. Hypothesis tests and multivariable models assessed associations. Fluid overload occurred in 32 of 158, or 20.2% of patients at 72 hours, and its presence was associated with lower weight with a p-value less than 0.001 and age with a p-value less than 0.001. On comparing those with and without fluid overload, we failed to identify an association with mortality or acute kidney injury. Mortality was 2 of 32 versus 11 of 126 with a mean difference of 2.5%, a 95% confidence interval of negative 11.9 to 10.2%, and a p-value equal to 0.65. Acute kidney injury was 1 of 32 versus 8 of 126 with a mean difference of 3.2%, a 95% confidence interval of negative 9.8 to 9.4%, and a p-value equal to 0.49. However, fluid overload compared with not was associated with adjusted relative increases in mechanical ventilation duration, 1.49 with a 95% confidence interval of 1.08 to 2.04 and a p-value equal to 0.04, and PICU length of stay, 1.44 with a 95% confidence interval of 1.04 to 2 and a p-value less than 0.001. Conclusions. In our retrospective cohort from 2011 to 2022, fluid overload occurred in approximately 1 in 5 pediatric TBI patients with moderate or severe injury. We also found that fluid overload was associated with an adjusted relative increase in mechanical ventilation duration, but we failed to identify an association with other outcomes. The PCCM narrative this month is entitled, "Are You Okay?" by Dr. Kilanani. "Hey," she said, her intonation dropped throughout the greeting. "Are you okay?" The warmth of her expression made it clear she could relate. After a couple days away, I was returning to my next overnight shift as a pediatric critical care physician. Walking into the ICU, I had the typical strut that comes with knowing your team, being way too familiar with your surroundings, and having a certain sharpness of mind, alert but relaxed, ready to deal with whatever comes our way. It's taken time to refine, but my pre-call rituals include exercise, bringing my children home from school, eating fruit with a protein bar, and partaking in the perfect amount of caffeine. The incorporation of a nap would go a long way, but I'm not LeBron James. Her question initially stopped me in my tracks. It also triggered a response that helped me acknowledge how messed up I was from the previous night on call. "No," I answered, "I'm not okay, but what can you do?" The evening in question began like countless others. I joked with colleagues as I entered the unit. To the layperson, it could appear I was excited to stay awake, like a madman, while most of our continent sleeps. I printed the handoff sheet and went into a room with the daytime attending for our ceremonious passing of the torch. While my partner delivered their narrative of the patients, I was glued to the computer screen, simultaneously assimilating vital signs, laboratory results, and imaging studies. For me, the computer investigation feels proactive, efficient, and self-improving. No doubt, it also quells certain anxieties I have in caring for critically ill children. Like so many, I make a distinguishing mark on my sheet near the patient's room number if the child is at high risk for decompensation or if their story doesn't add up. Those demarcated patients are the ones I evaluate first. Like any other day, I was given the most information about those who are high risk and least about those who are low risk. The efficiency in communication regarding low-risk patients is bizarrely validating despite its monotonous nature. It represents our collective agreement that we know more than enough about a patient's disease and condition. Sometimes this conclusion is dead wrong. The patient this night centered around, who I'll call San V, was low risk and therefore communicated in few words. The daytime attending left and I officially started my shift. I examined the patients who were lucky or unlucky enough to gain distinction on my papers, but not San V. I also spoke to fellows, nurses, and respiratory therapists, reviewed test results, and made changes to ventilators, blood pressure, and sedation medications. Despite the potential for chaos, the unit felt under control. And then it happened. "Can you look at Sanvi?" a bedside nurse requested. I paused to recall the 9-month-old girl I had reviewed earlier in our electronic medical record, the one whose profile picture showcased her furrowed brow, an uneven smile, and a protruding bottom lip, as if she was making a face at the camera. "Sure, let me check on one other thing and I'll be right over." "Actually, can you come over now?" the nurse reiterated. The look in her eyes was even more explicit. I rushed to the bedside, labored breathing, low oxygen levels, and pale appearance. Her central pulse, initially thready, quickly vanished between my fingertips. I thought, this isn't supposed to happen to this patient. We're all familiar with the choreography that followed. Chest compressions, bag mask ventilation, defibrillator pads, rhythm and pulse checks, code medications, etc. Unimaginable to the rest of the world, but acquired instinct for us. In Sanvi's room, I hypothesized we should get her back within a couple rounds of CPR, not truly understanding the cause of her arrest. 2 rounds of goal-directed cardiopulmonary resuscitation, or CPR, endotracheal intubation, and still no pulse. We activated extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, or ECMO, and I briefly left the room while resuscitation continued to update Sanvi's parents. "I am so sorry we're meeting this way. I'm not sure what caused Sanvi's heart to stop, but I believe we can stabilize her on ECMO." For the parents, this unfair introduction included an abbreviated explanation of central veno-arterial ECMO cannulation coupled with inadequate time to process. Over the next few days, we'll reassess her brain and vital organ function to help you understand what this all means over the long term. I genuinely apologize for being so short. I'll follow up with you as soon as I can. When I returned, the surgeon was at the bedside and the circuit was primed. CPR continued until Sanvi was cannulated onto ECMO. Unfortunately, the next few hours were uncharacteristically filled with aggressive resuscitation, a reminder that rescue therapies don't always live up to their name.
Despite our array of subspecialists, medications, and equipment, we were unable to stabilize, much less reverse end organ damage. Sanvi was dying, and we couldn't stop it. Hopeless. If I was reading this article, I'd have questions. But this isn't a medical inquiry. In many ways, that would be easier. Eventually, it was time. Eye contact between the physicians in the room confirmed our collective surrender. This wasn't supposed to happen, I again reflected. My discomfort immediately converted to action. We need to update Sanvi's parents and ask them how they want to spend their remaining time with her. During our next conversation, I observed myself. Despite trying everything, I said, your child is dying. There's nothing more we can do. We're so devastated by your loss and the loss of Sanvi. My voice trailed off as I thought of my own children. The words felt entirely inadequate. Not because they lacked in honesty, compassion, or even regret, but because they were just words, with no potential to fill the inevitable void that would follow. The expressionless stares on the parents' faces confirmed this. When will it hit them, I wondered, as if foreboding what was to come. And then it happened. That unmistakable wail that begins with a soft, deep-pitched moan and progresses within the course of a breath to a shrieking and prolonged cry. The entire unit felt their stomachs hit the ground, but it was actually our hearts. To me, this is the sound of the soul crying, and I wanted it to end. Sanvi's parents ultimately decided to withdraw medical and technological support. Before they entered her room for the last time, there was a heroic scurry. With the efficiency of a Formula One pit crew, our team cleaned her body from the blemishes of the day. She was wrapped in a woven and colorful throw blanket to conceal the catheters and destruction that could not be wiped away. These gestures added a brightness to the dark room. Shortly thereafter, Sanvi died in her parents' arms. Upon leaving the hospital, her father approached me to say thank you with a kind handshake and sincere eye contact that only made me feel worse. We then debriefed as a larger team to review the unanticipated event, not defined by the outcome, but instead by the effort and what we could learn for our next patient. And, with the clockwise rotation of the minute hand on the hospital wall clock, we moved forward. My global awareness of the ICU orchestra intensified. Alarms beeped, cell phones chirped, and the hum of staff chatter and medical equipment filled the air. The room, where the battle took place, was thoroughly cleaned and sanitized. With no gross evidence of its past, it was ready to support the living. But these impressions never leave us. An inadvertent glance at a hospital room on any given day conjures up specific names, faces, images, and stories. Non-healing wounds, in memoriam. Desensitized, yet tormented by cases we never forget. Stories like these seem all too ordinary, often feeling undeserving of attention or sharing with others. But that's a mistake, isn't it? Maybe we're also uncomfortable with acknowledging that the way we move forward, rituals intact with human-centered mission, is nothing short of extraordinary. That electronic medical record, dashboards, billing queries, satisfaction scores, or, dare I say, artificial intelligence will always fail to assimilate these types of human impact. Our marks don't register there. I'm okay with not being okay. To my colleagues across the world, I hope you're also okay. Lastly, we have an in memoriam for Dr. Daniel L. Levin by Dr. Sarah Gardner Yelton. Dr. Daniel L. Levin, pioneer in the field of pediatric critical care medicine, died secondary to complications associated with Parkinson's disease on June 19, 2025, with family at the bedside. Dan was my mentor, my colleague, my number one cheerleader, and also my stepfather. Despite being in my life for almost 30 years, I never fully understood the depth of Dan's contribution to the field of pediatric critical care until I cleaned out his desk after his death. As his naive child, I often thought to myself, or maybe sometimes not so much to myself, things have changed so much since he was practicing. What does he know about the nuances of the research world? Particularly when he critiqued what I thought was my final draft. Turns out the answer to that question was everything. I came across piles of manuscripts authored by my stepfather dating back to the 1970s explaining pulmonary hypertension in fetal pigs, the use of empiric antibiotics or bronchodilators in respiratory failure secondary to respiratory syncytial virus or RSV, or the ethical considerations for brain death. Things I do every day without a second thought, like adding papaverin to a spasming arterial line. There it was. Randomized controlled trial of papaverin continuous infusions to prevent failure of arterial catheters in pediatric patients. Dr. D. L. Levin, senior author. Born in 1943 in Chicago, Illinois,
Dr. Levin forged his own path to become a pediatric intensivist. He transferred from University of Michigan to complete a degree in English at the University of Illinois in Champaign, explaining his deeply rooted insistence on correct grammar and intentional word choice. You are not bagging the patient. You are providing bag mask ventilation to the patient. While attending medical school at the University of Illinois, where he also completed a master's degree in psychology, Dr. Levin noticed that very sick pediatric patients were grouped with less acute patients, which he felt did not allow for optimal care. In 1969, while in his pediatric residency at Rush Presbyterian St. Luke's, Dr. Levin capitalized on the idea of organizing medical care based on acuity and helped open the hospital's first four-bed PICU. Having no available defined training options for pediatric critical care medicine, Dr. Levin went on to complete a fellowship in pediatric cardiology at Children's Memorial Hospital in Chicago, and finally a fellowship in neonatology at the University of California in San Francisco, intentionally obtaining expertise in both cardiac and respiratory pathophysiology. Even during fellowship, Dr. Levin noticed lack of coordination of care between team members and early PICUs. There did not seem to be anybody focused on the whole patient, but rather solely on their individual subspecialty organ system. Armed with a unique set of skills, Dr. Levin and Dr. Francis Morris, anesthesiology, were recruited to the University of Texas Southwestern in Dallas to lead the new PICU. At the time, most PICUs were led by anesthesiology-trained individuals. From 1975 to 1996 at UT Southwestern, Dr. Levin became one of the first pediatricians to serve as PICU medical director, in addition to becoming a medical director of pediatric trauma intensive care at Parkland Memorial Hospital from 1987 to 1955. Under his and Dr. Morris's leadership, the program grew to 38 beds between the two hospitals, and the two trained 55 fellows in pediatric critical care from across the globe. Many of these fellows have contacted me since Dan's death, emphasizing the impact of his mentorship on their careers. Dan kept hard copies of every single abstract and paper his fellows went on to publish in a folder and took pride in all their successes. For an intensivist who carried the nickname Jaws due to his no-nonsense nature, he was a surprisingly sentimental softy whose kryptonite was any type of baked good. Dr. Levin used his platform as a pediatric leader to pass legislation to help prevent drowning, an enormous public health problem in the South. From 1984 to 1995, Dr. Levin headed an organization called Seeking Positive Leadership Against Swimming Hazards, or SPLASH, eventually getting an ordinance passed in Dallas for safety fencing. Dr. Levin also served on the Committee on Pool and Spa Drain Covers for the United States Product Safety Commission and was the chairman of the Drowning Prevention Committee for the Pediatric Section of the Society of Critical Care Medicine, or SCCM. He developed a strong interest in both ethics and brain death, becoming an expert in both areas, teaching university-level ethics courses, lecturing around the world, and ultimately publishing 50 manuscripts, including works in the early years of pediatric critical care medicine, countless abstracts, 32 book chapters, and serving as principal or senior investigator for 19 grant-funded projects. Dr. Levin's commitment to education and research helped push pediatric critical care medicine forward as a formally recognized field of its own. In the late 1970s, Dr. Levin was one of several individuals who petitioned SCCM to create a pediatric subsection and ultimately helped to build what, in 1987, would become the board-recognized subspecialty pediatric critical care. Dr. Levin and Dr. Morris wrote one of the first pediatric intensive care-specific textbooks. This textbook underwent four editions, was translated into multiple languages, and served as a guide for learners around the world. Dan used to tell me the story of meeting a senior pediatric intensivist who told him that as a resident, there was just one attending in the ICU. When the fellow had to be out of town, he would give the residents the textbook and say, "Just do what it says in here and you'll be okay." Dr. Levin further contributed to the academic rigor of the field of pediatric critical care by serving as an early member of the Pediatric Acute Lung Injury and Sepsis Investigators, or PALISI, sitting on the executive board from 2008 to 2017 and the senior advisory committee from 2018 until his death. Looking for a change of pace, Dr. Levin moved to Hanover, New Hampshire in 1996, recruited to Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center to build a six-bed PICU at Children's Hospital at Dartmouth. Involving families of critically ill children in the care of the child was incredibly important to him, and he participated fully in the design and build of the unit that would eventually become 10 beds, ensuring there was a space for families to sleep in each patient room. At Dartmouth, Dr. Levin taught as a professor in pediatrics and anesthesia and served as medical director of the PICU at Children's Hospital at Dartmouth from 1995 to 2005, developing a mobile critical care unit program and ultimately retiring from clinical work in 2013. In 2003, Dr. Levin received the Distinguished Career Award from the American Academy of Pediatrics Section on Critical Care Medicine, in addition to a recognition for major long-term contribution to intensive care of critically ill children at local, national, and international level at the World Federation of Pediatric Intensive and Critical Care Societies in 2011. Despite his many accomplishments, Dan was a humble, kind, and quiet man who loved sports, travel, wine, fishing, and beating my mother at Scrabble. But above all, he adored his grandchildren. In the last few years of his life, Dan moved to the Chicago suburbs to fill his final role as dampa to my two daughters, his only granddaughters, and a sea of 10 grandsons. Wanting to pass on some of his academic legacy, Dan included me in his long-term research on the origins of pediatric critical care. We collaborated on multiple projects, including a textbook chapter. And in his final days, he filled his hospital time by editing and editing and editing whatever drafts I brought him of our most recent manuscript. One of the last things I, very fittingly, said to him was, "We have gotten it under the word count," to which he responded, eyes closed, with a thumbs up and a smile. In addition to his grandchildren, Dan is survived by his wife, Judy, three children, Micah, Brendan, and Aaron, and four stepchildren, Ryan, Abby, Tyler, and Sarah. I hear Dan's guidance every time I walk into a resuscitation telling me, always take your pulse before you take the patient's pulse. I pass these words of wisdom on to all my trainees and try to live my life by the same standard, for example, when dealing with a toddler tantrum. Thank you, Dan, for your life's commitment to the health of children, your insistence on excellence, and your persistence in making the world a better place. I miss you every day. This concludes the abstracts for the December 2025 issue of Pediatric Critical Care Medicine. Thank you very much for listening. For more journal-related content, including access to the articles mentioned in this recording, please visit pcmjournal.org. Members of the SCCM Pediatric Section receive complimentary access to the PCCM Journal.